Hello and welcome to the Lakeshore Records podcast, On Cue With. I'm your host, Alon Levitin, and for today's episode, I had the enormous pleasure of speaking with award-winning composer Chris Bowers and Katja Richardson about The Last Repair Shop. This is easily one of the best documentaries I've ever seen. It's one of those incredibly rare, life-affirming projects where everyone on camera and behind the scenes is a wellspring of inspiration. In our wide-ranging conversation, Katja, Chris, and I discuss the many splendors of learning an instrument, the genius of Keith Jarrett, Prokofiev, Flying Lotus, and Bach, the connection between persistence and authenticity, recording an orchestra of LAUSD alumni, the hidden contributions of our ancestors, how to destroy the ego with insignificance, the orchestration of Peter and the Wolf, self-discovery and the road to catharsis, what musical instruments would say about us if they could speak, the purity and darkness of childhood, the externalization of the idea of repair, and so much more. I highly recommend you watch The Last Repair Shop on YouTube today and listen to Katja and Chris's phenomenal score album, which is out now worldwide. I hope you enjoy my conversation with Katja and Chris as much as I did.
Thank you both for joining us. You guys absolutely crushed this. Straight up, this is a masterpiece.
Thank you.
This documentary is so well done. The storytelling, musical storytelling, just everything about it really resonated with me very, very deeply as someone who has gone through LAUSD, completely unaware that there were people behind the scenes doing this sort of thing. So thank you, honestly, is the first thing I just wanted to say for making this.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, thank you. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for the kind words. Yeah.
What was the origin of this project?
Ben Proudfoot, my co-director, he found out about the repair shop through an article that one of our producers, Jeremy Lambert, sent him. And this was actually 4 years ago. We were maybe even a little over 4 years ago, but we were working on a Concertos of Conversation at that time, the documentary about my grandfather. While we were finishing it up, Ben was like, "Have you ever heard of the repair shop?" And, you know, kind of told me a little bit about it. And he had started interviewing some of the craftspeople and inviting me to come down to check it out. And similar to you, I never knew it existed. I never thought about how the instruments that I played most of my childhood were repaired. I was really just kind of blown away by the space and like their dedication to their craft and how much heart goes into repairing these instruments. And then I also found out that Steve, who's the piano technician, actually tuned the pianos at my middle school and elementary school. And so for me, it felt like an immediate yes in terms of being a part of it. And then we just continued to chip away at it over the last 4 years. And it was definitely a labor of love until we finished it earlier this year.
Wow, 4 years. That's a long time.
Yeah, I mean, we got stopped by COVID for a little bit of that. And then we, you know, with those four interviews, the first cut that Nick Wright, our editor, put together that Ben shared with me was like over an hour. And then we tried getting that down. And then we thought to add kids, which then, you know, made it a little bit longer again, trying to figure out at some point we were talking about, do we make this a series and have each of them have their own quote unquote episode? Do we, you know, make this a feature? And I think, you know, just wanting it to be something that as many people could watch as possible, trying to find a way to make it all fit in that short form felt like a challenge we wanted to take on. And so, yeah, it really is kudos to Nick, our editor, that made it happen over the 4 years that he also put work into it.
How did the initial conversations about the music, there's a very meta aspect to it. How did you two meet? And then what were the conversations like?
How I got involved with this, I had been working with Ben on a few projects before, and I had been a fan of A Concerto as a Conversation. That's how I first got introduced to Ben and Chris as an amazing director duo. And I first met Chris, I think, Chris, you were maybe a few years older than I am now. So it was really this weird full circle moment. This was our first collaboration. And I really appreciated the amount of trust in the process, like from the very, very start. The fact that Chris and Ben have been working on this project for 4 years, and I'm sure, Chris, like from a musical standpoint, you had a very specific idea how you saw the score, and after spending so much time with the interviews, the kids, and all the craftspeople, so I appreciate that there was that trust from the beginning and kind of freedom for me to have that artistic liberty. Some of the earliest conversations were about the sound of the score, like how we wanted it to sound intimate and kind of reflect each instrument family that we hear the craftspeople talk about. So we have Dana, who's in charge of strings, Patty, who's in charge of brass, and sort of taking that like Peter and the Wolf approach to the score. And so each instrument family kind of leads us through each of their stories. Composing a score about a film that's about music is this very meta thing, as it's very daunting to have that be a reflective process and think about how music has affected me. How do I respond to all these experiences that I've had?
One of the many things that I really appreciate about it is that it didn't feel like documentary music at all. It was very cinematic to me. And I think it was both intimate and big. I really appreciated, as you said, Peter and the Wolf sort of approach. Can you actually just break that down a little bit? Because I find that to be really interesting.
Peter and the Wolf is this piece composed by Prokofiev. It has this narrator, and it's actually a children's work. The clarinet, for example, in the story reflects this cat. Different instruments, like a bassoon, I think, is a duck. And there are these different instruments that lead us through the story and come back every time those characters come back. So reflecting that with this, with each craftsperson that's in charge of a musical instrument, and featuring those instruments that we see on screen that are being talked about. For example, with Dana, he's a string technician, so we only hear stringed instruments like harps, guitars, piano, and strings. With Patty, it was a brass heavy and forward section. I think Chris and I found just focusing on the instrument families to be too restrictive, and like ultimately the story was the most important thing. So there were exceptions. So we, even though Patty, that section was very brass driven, strings and other woodwinds, and had moments to pop up and support from underneath. So yeah, just really being led by the instruments we hear. And then at the end, culminating in a full orchestral soundtrack, the amazing piece that Chris wrote.
You're sort of honoring the instruments of our expression and of these kids' expression. And then you're using the instruments of our expression to do that. You captured sonically all the emotion and blood, sweat, and tears of all these kids and the actual shop and their backstories with the orchestra in a way that is so big and in like enriching and galvanizing. And I just thought that was really masterfully done. And I wanted to ask Chris actually what it was like to be behind the scenes in terms of directing.
Yeah, I think on this level, you know, Ben and I shared directing credit on A Concerto as a Conversation, but I think that this one was much more, I was much more involved with Concerto. It was really because I interviewed my grandfather and help guide that story. That's something that, you know, Ben and I talked about being worthy of that direct co-director title. But with this one, it was much more, you know, I interviewed the kids and also like watching all of the edits, going into the edit and working on the edit together. And, you know, with that end sequence, that was a really fascinating process in terms of our collaboration, because we basically visualized what we wanted to shoot as I was writing the piece of music. So the piece of music was dictated by what we talked about seeing, and then vice versa. When we actually went to go film it, obviously that was all dictated, or the cut of that and the pace of that was all dictated by the music. And so it was really a lot of fun to talk about, you know, starting with that shot of Porsche and pulling back and knowing that we needed that single violin to carry us out of the score into this big moment. And we were going to have this why that we would cut to that, you know, needed to come in with a bang with the score and have this really thrilling and exhilarating, and like you said, galvanizing type of feel to it. And then talking about, you know, call and response or moments where we know we wanted to focus on certain sections and certain type of sweeping camera movement. So it was really fun to like talk about what we wanted to see and then for me to write the piece based on that. And then Ben and I sat together and went over the score and actually talked about, created a shot list on the actual score itself. And I think that that process was something that I've always dreamed of doing, like having music be something that's, you know, dictating the way that we're filming something. And it was a lot of fun to work on that together.
So you knew there was going to be an opus. At the end, we're going to have some sort of opus, but you didn't know what that opus was.
Yeah, you know, it started off with, once we involved the kids, or even before we involved the kids, one thing that Ben and I talked about pretty early on was knowing that we wanted to end the movie in a way that gave thanks to these individuals. And like one idea we talked about was having an auditorium full of LAUSD alumni that give them a standing ovation. But we talked about Mr. Holland's opus being also like a really big reference for us. And we started talking about this idea of like having this big performance at the end. And literally maybe like a short while before we put it all together, we started to really formulate this idea of having an orchestra filled with LAUSD alumni and having it be from the ages of 7 to 70. And Peter Rotter, our executive producer, who actually introduced Ben and I in the first place, he helped us put together that whole orchestra. And then, I wrote the piece over a weekend, pretty much a few days. And then we filmed it in one day. Like we had 3 hours to actually record it. And then the rest of the day to just capture filming and have them, you know, kind of mime to what was already recorded. But that ensemble only had 3 hours to record it, which was really exciting, but also a little daunting, just given like the difference in abilities and unique instrumentation that's not really that common. And but they obviously incredibly put it all together. And then and then we had the rest of the day to just film it, and they were all really amazing with that. And the last thing I'll say about that piece is that while we were recording it, Peter came to tell us that he and most of the musicians were going to donate their time for free because they were LAUSD alumni and felt so passionate about giving back to this repair shop that gave so much to them as kids. And I think Ben and I were really bowled over with a lot of emotion thinking about how many people contributed their talents and their services to this project for free.
It was so moving, and that piece in particular, that bottom end right from the beginning, like, I'm ready to go into battle or like off a cliff or something. And I actually wanted to ask you, maybe if you could break it down a little bit, how are you able to keep it moving so beautifully? Because it kind of starts like level 11. That's tricky, right? In terms of composition, where do you go from there and how do you make it keep moving?
Yeah, I think shape-wise, it was just knowing that it needed to start there and end big. And so therefore it kind of already creates this shape where the middle section needs to like have a bit more of a calm energy compared to those two poles on either side of the piece. The other thing that was helpful is I already had all of the themes. And so beginning of our process with Katya, I just gave Katya piano sketches of each of the themes for the characters. These sketches were literally just one iteration of the melody, and that's pretty much it. I'm still blown away how much Katya created this world of score and this sound from these just simple piano sketches. For the ending, having those sketches also really dictated how that flow is going to happen. Each theme is actually also heard in the order that we meet the characters. So it starts off with this like kind of big fanfare, but I knew it was going to go from that fanfare into Dana's theme, and then into Patty's theme, and then into Dwayne's hoedown. Which what was really fun about that too is the theme that I wrote for him, for the end, we also borrowed a melody that he actually wrote that he calls the Repair Shop Hoedown. That melody he's playing is something that he wrote. We found a way to fit into that, and then ending with this like sweeping emotional theme that was Steve's. So I think having those themes already set was really helpful, knowing like, and the order already set, then it was just about following that shape that felt really clear, and knowing that we needed to do all this in like 3 minutes. And so I think having that framework really just was like following the music and just letting it kind of unfold the way that it felt like it needed to.
Nice. Well, I'm aware of Chris's instrument as piano, but Katya, what is your instrument story?
It also starts with piano. I started out as a classical pianist and grew up in a really musical family. My dad's used to be a touring musician, doesn't do that as much anymore, but I grew up around a lot of different kinds of music, a lot of jazz and big bands and rock and roll. So it's kind of inevitable that piano, that I would pursue that in some way. But then the piano was really like my gateway into composing and writing music because of improvising. I didn't like practicing at all, and I'd much rather make mistakes in the Mozart I was practicing and make up my own chords and find my own sound. The piano was really the first place where I got to express my own emotions, learn empathy. Interfacing with music that was written hundreds of years ago just taught me that too, like how to interpret someone else's work and also see it through my own eyes. It all started at the piano, and still I'm very tactile in my creative process, and everything still starts there. And even though I don't get to play as much as I would like, it's still very much a part of my identity and process.
That's super interesting what you said about empathy. Can you just break that down a little bit for me more?
Yeah, I think the empathy part speaks not only to piano, but to any instrument. And that's why I think tying it back to music education and learning an instrument as a kid, I just think it teaches you these important life lessons of empathy, getting to play with others, each person playing their part too, and learning how to come in on time and how to express themselves through music. And the piano is just my way that I found that. But I really find that it's a very orchestral and cinematic instrument. I used to do dance and ballet as a kid, and in some classes we had a live accompanist, and I was always so appalled at how they'd take famous ballet pieces like Tchaikovsky Nutcracker, for example, and the piano reduction still sounded so orchestral and all the layers were there. And that's what I really love about the instrument, is that you can still hear all those layers. There's the deep low end and the high end, and it just gives you that full range. So all of my ideas start there because of that cinematic quality.
I believe there's a line in the movie, "What would the instrument communicate about you if it could speak?" And I'm curious, how would both of you answer that about your pianos? What would they say about you if they could talk?
I think for me, my piano probably just knows my deeper secrets, essentially. Yeah, I definitely am an emotional person, but like not that outwardly emotional, and don't really talk about any sort of inner conflict with many people other than like my wife and my therapist, essentially. So I feel like, and you know, even then I feel like there's something different with the piano in terms of how you can express in such an unfiltered way. Like if I'm incredibly angry and I want to like bang on the piano, that's something I can do. Or if I'm feeling really sad and work through that on the piano, it's received such a wide range of emotions. You know, the piano, if it could talk, would see me as a much more emotional person than I think anybody else in my life.
Fascinating.
Yeah, I would kind of say the same thing as well. The piano is, I guess, my closest companion in some ways, because I spend so much time with it, and knowing those strengths and weaknesses of what chords do I gravitate to all the time and what am I afraid of too. Those two extremes of the extreme comforts with music and the discomforts too, and the expression being the most innermost part of myself and getting to express myself more clearly than in words.
What are you scared of?
Comfort and habit, getting too comfortable and repeating myself, always being able to come up with new ideas or not circle back to the same ones.
It's interesting to hear you both articulate this, because for me, it certainly, I echo what you're both saying. Of course, it helps me express my conscious emotions. But for me, primarily, the piano becomes an instrument for me to express discover my emotion. I'm not that in tune when I'm having a rough day, all these emotions, right? And I don't really know what they are. And I just sit down, what's going to come out of me? And then I'm like, oh, damn, I got to work through that, right? Like that was, oh, okay. Yeah. Or sometimes it'll be a literal catharsis that I'm seeking and I'll play and I don't get it because it's not authentic. And it's like, this is just not, I got to keep going until I find the meat of where I'm at in this moment. Mm. And for me, it's like almost like a discovery process.
That's really cool.
That's awesome.
I'm curious, the kids, I mean, they're just gold. You put your anybody in front of a camera and you really get their life story and you're curious enough, you're going to get some really good stuff. But from the very first frame, I'm sorry, I don't know her the name.
Porsche is her name, yeah.
I mean, I was just like, where did they find? And then the next one, and then the next. It reminded me so happily of what it's like to be that age. So pure, and but they're so charismatic and genuine. How did you find them, narrow them down?
We reached out to a mentor of mine. His name is Tony White. He does a lot of education for LAUSD, music education for LAUSD. And he reached out to a handful of schools and asked those schools to put forward their, you know, best and brightest students, essentially, like music students. And we got, I want to say, like maybe 12 students or so. I can't remember the actual number. But when you watch the film at the very end, you see this montage of a lot of other students that we didn't actually meet. And we interviewed all of those students, actually. And we knew that we wanted to whittle it down to students that would represent each of these departments. So strings and brass and woodwinds and piano. Those ones just spoke to something that we felt really reflected what was being talked about in each of those craftspeople's stories as well. The thing that I was really fascinated by is we could have made a documentary just about all of these kids in terms of like what they each had going on in their personal lives and their willingness to be open about that, their clarity in talking about how much music helps them through those things. I remember going into interviewing the kids, and there are times where I think about younger people now that I'm like a little older than them, that I feel like, oh, you know, you kids, you don't know what tough is. Like, you haven't experienced, like, you know, anything hard. And each of those conversations, I was floored by how much they dealt with needing to flee the country they were from because, you know, there were violent threats against, you know, their father and their family, or like, you know, another immigrant that came and couldn't speak English. And so violin was the only way he could communicate to or collaborate and feel a part of the school that he was in. And the ones that we feature, I mean, Porsche talking about her family dealing with health issues, which continued even after we finished shooting, and Amanda talking about mental health, how much she's stressed about being successful and like, what is she going to be in her future? And so I think I was just reminded, not only when I was a kid, how real anything that I was dealing with felt, but also their are very real challenges for kids that any human would have a difficult time moving through. It also reminded me how much we're in this time right now where there's a mental health crisis for kids. And I imagine that it's even harder to be a kid now than it was even when I was younger. And so, yeah, I just really appreciate each of them opening up. And like you said, what was so fascinating is that they talk about these difficult things and yet still have this light about them and this hopefulness, and to have both this light and, you know, the darkness of their experiences in the same human experience is just really beautiful to witness.
Yeah. And that level of awareness too, and sort of acceptance, very mature. How would you say that music functioned for you as a kid growing up when you first got into music? What was it to you? How did it feel?
Self-discovery. I think before I knew how to process emotions, like you said earlier about having that catharsis and sitting down in an instrument and figuring out what it is you're going through, discovering a deep connection with people, being able to feel so deeply when I heard others playing music or people having such a positive response and encouraging me when I was playing music too, just that deep connection and the ability to have conversations that sort of transcend generations too. And that's what I love about this film, is that despite age, you have young kids and then these craftspeople, that music is this connecting thing. Like, they've all had a path in music, whether they're just starting out or they're repairing instruments. I know it's cheesy, but music is universal, and it is a language and something that I think all humans can tap into. It's one of those few things. There are no downsides to learning music, to listening to music. It just causes so much joy. And I think that is something I've turned to in various times of my life, like extreme moments of joy, and then needing to turn to it for extreme moments of comfort too. And that being an all-encompassing journey in learning more about myself. It's very reflective. Learning an instrument will give you what you're looking for, whether you're pursuing it seriously or not. If you're looking for comfort, if you're looking for joy, if you're looking for community, you'll get what you're looking for.
It's almost like learning the instrument is learning yourself.
Yeah, absolutely.
And the instrument is just, it's like something that you can actually manipulate to some degree, where you're playing with something external, but expressing yourself through it. You really hone your skills and you're really present, then you can see who you really are via that instrument, and really share that with people. I like the idea also that runs through the entire thing. Obviously, it's called The Last Repair Shop. This idea that things are broken and can be repaired. And it really made me think about that conceptually, like, what does it mean to be broken? What does it mean to be repaired? And how do you know at what point you're broken and what point you're repaired, right? It's pretty self-evident if you have a busted key or whatever. There's sort of this through line that's really, really interesting with these kids and these individuals in the repair shop who have these very trying situations, you know, really touch on my heart in terms of like, we're all broken in some way, and we could all use a little repair in some way. And so I really appreciated that. It's not really a question. It's more just an observation. I'm curious if you have any thoughts on that.
Yeah, I think that was one of the biggest things that attracted Ben and I to this story, is the externalization of that idea of, you know, repair. I remember when we were texting about like how to figure this thing out and like how to fit the kids in, and we just text each other ideas. And I remember giving my daughter a bath. She had a scar from a fall, and it was like one of the first times that she had a visible scar on her body. And my wife was really emotional about it, and she was really sad. She was like, you know, like, she was perfect, and now she has this little like mark that will maybe go away or maybe be there for a lot of her life. And I was just talking to Ben about how, like, especially when you think about kids, it's so scary to think about something happening where they are in a moment where they feel like broken, but also just how much value there is in going through those experiences and healing through them, and who you are on the other side of those moments of feeling broken. And at the same time, what's so interesting is we think about instruments, and the instruments that are hundreds of years old are the most valuable instruments. Like, you think about the Stradivarius or the Mark VI tenor or whatever it is, like, those instruments are far better than instruments that were just built yesterday because of the wear and tear and like being played over and over and over again. And so we were just talking about how much there's this preciousness about things that haven't been broken or haven't been like impacted in that way. But at the same time, we also obviously as a society recognize there's this incredible value in something that has weathered the storms and has gotten to this, you know, matured place, whether it be instruments or humans. And so that definitely felt like another reason that this shop and what it represented on this more symbolic level was important. And then Ben also was just saying how, like, we're in a state now where we think about how divisive everything is. And, you know, people talk about tearing down institutions and destroying things. And like, while there's so much validity for that type of mentality and that emotional reaction to a lot of the issues happening, there's also like something to be said about trying to find a way to repair what is. And I think that like that's something else that we feel is an important idea to consider these days.
I thought it was just so powerful that to see that these are individuals who are dedicating their lives to repair, that is what they're doing. They are instruments of change and productivity, essentially. Because I mean, it's really true what they say in the film. But I remember I had a valve trombone that there's just one key down and I'm screwed. Like, I got a solo coming up. Like, you know, like, what do I do? And like, I love blowing shit out of that thing, you know, as a kid. Like, I didn't really know what I was doing exactly in that first year. I don't remember. It just like disappeared and then like reappeared perfectly, all like better than it was before. And it felt good. It just felt really good to have it fixed and then have this new instrument that I didn't pay for, right? Just show up in my hands, and then I get to go do the little solo. And people don't really think about how profound that little act is on the psyche of a young kid. What it got me thinking about was ancestors. You don't see your ancestors, right? You don't see all the blood, sweat, and tears of what they put in and what they've done to lift up the future, essentially. Same with your parents, right? You're not aware of what's going on with them. And I just thought that it was really interesting to see that these individuals are so dedicated to doing that, and what a profound impact that has on, I think it was 80,000 kids or something like that.
80,000 instruments, but actually since we filmed, it's now over 130,000 instruments. Yeah, and it's only 12 technicians.
That's crazy. It's amazing. And I love when he said, I forgot the individual's name, I'm sorry, but he said, not in our city.
Oh, Steve, yeah.
Oh, LA. So, you know, one of those moments where you can feel very prideful about this city. Mm.
That's another thing I really love about the film, is that it's not only a love letter to music, but LA as well. I think LA is such a diverse city, but what unites us is the very reasons we're here and like what brings us here. I think it's a city of hope and high ambition and a city of dreamers too. And just the fact that all these craftspeople come from different backgrounds, different paths, ambitions, trials and tribulations, that they all end up in this nondescript warehouse in LA just speaks to that commonality that they all have, that they're hopeful people and wanting to repair something and having that ambition for something greater too is what I really love.
There's another theme that runs through there in terms of persistence, not giving up. What does that mean to you two in terms of your trajectory? How much specificity do you have around that? Do you have a very clear vision of your future, your path, and not giving up on that? Or is there a general idea of persistence? I'm just going to make music. I'm going to tell stories. What does it mean to you?
So my family, my mom is a Ukrainian immigrant. So she instilled the idea of hard work very, very early on. And despite anything you're going through, just keep going. And eventually you'll be successful, or eventually you'll have those opportunities. So that ambition has been a North Star in my process and everything, like through high school, through college, and now. And it's not just within music, it's within everything, just always wanting to be a better person, building through difficult times and creating opportunities, not only for myself, but for others too. And the idea of uplifting people. But within music, I think there's such a steep learning curve with practicing. Like, you really have to put a lot of time in, not so much with piano because we have that tuning already there, but say like learning violin is like one of the hardest instruments to learn as a kid, because of that tuning and having to get the fingers just right on the right note. And yeah, just the amount of time that it takes, that dedication and persistence to keep trying again, to keep coming back to something that when you start out with, you're not very good at, and seeing the potential within yourself and getting encouragement from teachers and mentors and building that sense of community. So I think persistence has very much been a part of my journey and is something I think about quite a lot.
Do you have a clear vision of your trajectory? Do you have a goal or something that you envision as you move forward?
I want to write music that connects with people. That's my ultimate goal, is to be able to contribute something in the fabric of music. And you mentioned ancestry and people that have come before. I just want to contribute to that conversation and not necessarily reinvent the wheel, but create something that people resonate with and emotionally connect to, wherever that takes me within film scoring or in my dance work or in concert music. That's all music to me. So just continuing to, I know this is very broad, but continuing to just make music that's reflective of me and my voice and my experiences.
To a degree, at the center of, if I'm hearing you right, authenticity
to express
is if you have, if there's something that you're going to be persistent about and disciplined about, your path is going to be to a degree centered around expressing yourself authentically.
Totally. Yeah. It's all about finding your voice and sticking to it. And then the right people will come and find you and be like, hey, I like what you're doing. I want to work with you, or I want to support you. And I'm a big proponent of that, of working with people that believe in me and protecting my voice and integrity. Because I think it's so easy in an age where we have so much social media and so many outside influences to constantly be comparing yourself to other people. And I think especially now, it's so important to hold on to that inner voice and pursue that as much as possible.
Yeah, I just want to echo what you're saying and lift it up a little bit just for anybody listening. Just the reason that I'm teasing this out and often trying to tease this out so much, just to notice that what you're saying is very different than, like, I want to win 5 Oscars.
And I'm curious. I'm not saying that, but
yeah, that might be
Not the reason why I'm in this field.
And Chris, every time I sneeze, I'm discovering 5 new amazing things that you're doing. And I, generally speaking, don't even understand how you can walk and talk just with, given the amount of work I imagine you're doing. Do you have a vision of your path?
You know, I think vaguely, like, there definitely are things I'd like to do. And I want to, just as Katya said, make things that have some sort of resonance and impact and last beyond me for especially for, like, my daughter or, like, any other kids that we have, or just, like, any generations that come after it. This is the field that I've chosen to be in, and so I hope that whatever I do has some sort of impact in the same way, like you were saying, ancestors. The life that I have is the vision or the dream or the wildest imagination of, like, you know, so many people that came generations before me that their work led to. For me, my hope is that whatever I'm doing has some sort of ripple effect in that same kind of way for my children and the ones that come afterward. And there are definitely spaces I want to operate in, and, like, continuing to make film, continuing to score film, continuing to make music that exists in the concert space, or, like, for me, I'm really fascinated by, like, multidisciplinary, like, immersive type of projects and having music be at the center of that. So doing that kind of thing. But as far as persistence goes, there are a few things I think about. One, whenever you look at, you know, these people that have these prolific careers, I always remind myself how it's the result of consistency over time. If John Williams stopped at 7, 8 years or even 10 years, he wouldn't be John Williams. John Williams is who he is because of how many years and years and years he continued to put out music on such a high level. And so it's a reminder that the job's not finished, and, like, continuing to try to do work as well as I can on as high of a level as I can for as long as I can. And that's the only thing that's going to amount to something that we can look back at and have the type of impact that I would hope that, or be really honored to have in these fields and in this industry. And the other thing I think about is just kind of what Katya was saying as well about her mom and her parents. Like, my parents and my grandparents, you know, I remember talking to my grandfather for concerto. Like, he didn't have the luxury of stressing about what am I going to do, and, like, and what's the future going to be, and, like, what's the impact I'm going to have. I just need to get the job done and, like, work on a day-to-day basis. And, you know, does my family have food on the table tonight and, like, tomorrow? Like, let me just focus on that. Just get the job done. And same with my parents. Like, my mom was, you know, the primary breadwinner in our household, and, like, was up every day at, you know, 5, 6 in the morning, drove to work, was at work until, like, 5 or 6 at night. She came home most of the time and still, like, made us dinner. And I never heard my mom ever, like, talk about being sad about that life. It was just like, this is what I have to do for my family. And, like, you know, my dad, with how much he was present for me with music and, like, driving me to and from school, like, I feel like there's just such a stoic approach to dedication and persistence in older generations that now it's definitely helpful for me to be aware of any emotions that are coming up in the face of, like, you know, persistence. But at the same time, that stoicism, I feel like, is what actually got so much work done and so much progress in those generation. And so that's something I always try to think of, is like, just like put my head down and get the work done, and you know, be aware of anything that's coming up that makes it difficult to persist, but those emotions will pass and I just, you know, can continue to move forward.
What, as creatives, would you attribute to your ability and willingness to endure this sort of uncharted life of critique and vulnerability?
Keeping in mind that in a field such as film scoring, that the utmost importance is to uplift a story, and it's not about us. Any critique is never really personal. That's just the nature of the industry. And it's important to be open-minded, set this ego aside, and have really vulnerable conversations. And the story is the most important thing at the very end of the day, is just to how can we all make this film better, is essentially what I always try to keep in mind.
Okay, but million-dollar question, how do you set your ego aside?
I think that definitely took practice and persistence, and I keeping in mind that we're part of this bigger system, this bigger picture, and that there have been so many people that have come before and will come after, kind of thinking of my own insignificance in some ways, both the insignificance and the power to contribute. So I think setting the ego aside is, okay, I'm just this small dot in a sea of music, but I have the power to amplify a story or make a difference with my music in this particular project, or with a certain person that I can connect with. So it's those two feelings simultaneously that help me focus, I think.
That's so interesting, because it makes me think of this. So my wife is, we joke about it, she's like terrified of space, the idea of space, right? Because it's like so vast, she would never want to be out in space. When she thinks about it too much, when she zooms out too much, it messes with her head. And I love it, right? It's so vast. For me, I'm like, it's interesting, because it's almost like what you said is a perfect integration of both of us, where we are both insignificant in the vast scheme of things, but we are here right now. Of all the times and of all the space, we are here in this moment where there's, as far as we know, not that much life in this massive universe, or multiverse, depending on how you want to look at it, or I guess both. So I totally feel, I think that's actually a really insightful answer to the question. Thank you. I'm going to just keep that section for myself. I'm going to have to return to this section.
I had to think about it for a second, but I was like, oh, wait, those two things have never connected for me. So thank you for letting me verbalize that.
Sure, no. Chris, how do you put your ego aside?
I think for me, a big part of it is I come from a family where it's all of us doing things for the family, right? So like up until high school, it was like, okay, mom needs to go do this, so we're all getting in the car to go do this. You know, mom and dad need to go do this thing, so we're all going to go do this thing. Or grandma and granddaddy need us to do this, so we're all going to go over there. There was never really a consideration of like, oh, I don't want to do that. I want to do this other thing. I was kind of like brought up in this mentality of, okay, yeah, like that's what we got to do. Like always an effort to like, as like Katya was saying, contribute to the larger good, to like contribute to the whole, that I think had me grow up in a way where I honestly had to learn the other thing. I had to kind of learn what I wanted, or like what I preferred to do. Or I definitely grew up with that type of environment that allowed me, or kind of bred me in a way that it became easy to put aside my ego. I think the other thing is that I love collaboration, and I feel like the most interesting things come out of collaboration. And maybe that also goes to my background as a jazz musician, where like the most beautiful things come out of like, you know, a trumpet player taking a solo and playing a note that does not fit in this chord, and me being like, okay, like that's the note you chose. Like, let's see how we can make that work. Say yes and allow somebody else to take the lead, and like everybody to go in that direction. And anytime that somebody's like trying to force their will on the situation, everything dies. Like the creativity dies, the energy dies. And so that egoless approach to continuing to like listen and reach out and see what we can do, I think we're the best and most fruitful playing experiences. So when it goes into like film, I love the collaborative experience of a director saying like, that doesn't feel nostalgic to me. And instead of me being like, no, that definitely feels nostalgic, I'm like, oh, okay, well, like what's nostalgic to you? And they'll start talking about what they want to feel. And I always feel like I find some really interesting way of representing that emotion that I never considered before because this other person led me there. It's very easy for me to put my ego aside because I always feel like Katya said, we're aiming for this, we're serving this larger idea, like the story, the, you know, whatever the story is trying to serve, if it's trying to serve a larger idea than the movie itself. In addition to that, whenever a collaborator has a different approach to something or like feels like I'm not going in the direction they're looking for, actually every time that I decide to like try to find out what it is that they're imagining, I find something new for myself as an artist. And so like finding that new discovery on a regular basis is much more fruitful to me than like staunchly standing in this idea of like, I know what's right, or like, this is what I think should happen.
I want to ask you real quick about what you said when you were younger. You said that when your family, if someone had to do something, everyone would go do that thing. Is that accurate?
Yeah.
Literally?
Literally, like when my mom went to go get my nails done, we got in the car and like we went to, and my dad and I sat in the car while she got her nails done, or my dad went and did something else. I remember being in high school and my parents being like, okay, it's Saturday, we're going to, or Sunday, we're going to go to the grocery store. We have to go to, you know, Ralph's and Costco. And I was like, I'm going to stay home and practice. And like my parents were upset by it. Like, what do you mean? Like, that's not how this works. Like, we're going to do this together as a family. And it also came from, my parents didn't have the family dynamic, the nucleus family dynamic that they wanted. And so for them, they were like, we want our kids together all the time. We want to be together as a family all of the time. And they also wanted to serve their like elders all of the time and kind of be a representation of that for us as well. And so, yeah, it was like a really big shift for them when I, as I got older, asked for autonomy. And up until that point, the idea of having autonomy didn't even like pop in my head. I was just like, this is what we do. Like, it wasn't until I started talking to other kids where like, you go to the grocery store with your parents every weekend? Like, why do you do that? You don't have to do that. And I was like, oh, I guess I don't have to do that. But like up until that point, I was like, yeah, like that's what we do. Any little errand that we were doing on the weekend, we all did together. Yeah.
It's really fascinating to hear you say that, because the show that you did at the Disney, the second show, Bridgerton.
Yeah, it was a French horn concerto. Yeah.
One of the most amazing shows I've ever been to in my entire life. And there was a moment where I wasn't stoned or anything, but I swear to God, you were playing the piano, and I swear it was almost like you were flying. You were just like improvising. And I believe it was like COVID time, right? And your wife was up in the corner. She was involved in the production and genesis of the ideas, right? And yep. So they're like, you're there. You're what? I want to say she was pregnant.
Was she pregnant? Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Like, and was like kind of on bed rest, like wasn't supposed to be there actually. And she still, because she directed all those visuals. So we're like, you have to go to see this happen.
Your unborn child is hearing the music, and like your family, like the multi-generational thing. And I've seen at the previous concerto, your family was so supportive and so present. Actually present in this multi-generational thing. I was like, now I get him. Now I understand. It was just like such an amazing thing. I've never seen anything like the show in and of itself, but to be aware of the family dynamic that's going on there was just incredible. Just truly incredible.
Thanks. Yeah.
Let's get some quick rapid fire wrap up questions. Whatever comes to mind. Do you have a favorite sound?
That's a good question. I really, like, orchestrationally, I love the combination of cellos and horns, or, like, cellos and clarinets. I think that's such a beautiful color, but I also equally love weird electronic sounds. Like, I'm always on the hunt for, like, an electronic sound I've never heard before, like, hyper-tactile, percussive stuff I love.
I would say horns and celli as well, or, like, horns and flute maybe, but, like, anything with horn. Horn and cello are actually my favorite instruments above piano, even though I don't play them. But that orchestrationally, and the other thing that came to my mind is not even musical. I'm imagining like the times I've hiked in Big Sur, the sound in that environment, like in a redwood forest, or being that close to the water and like having that in the air. And I think that sound is something that just brings me a lot of peace.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you both more. Top three artistic heroes that come to mind in this moment not all time, just in this moment, that's influencing you these days or you're listening to that you're digging?
I think for me, I would say Keith Jarrett, Bach, just because like I've always been fascinated by how beautiful his music is while also being very mathematical. And I'm like a pretty like mathematical dude, so I've always loved that about Bach. Kendrick, I'm gonna say. Yeah.
Cool.
I think for me, Flying Lotus, I really love his like electro jazz influence. It's just so cool. Prokofiev is always an artist I keep coming back to because I love how much he gets away with the orchestra, like orchestrationally and the colors and the sounds without using avant-garde techniques. He's kind of on that very edge. He's just so creative in that way. And Sophie, which is a like hyper electronic tactile artist who passed away a few years ago, but her music has been a huge influence on my more electronic stuff.
Are there any questions that come to mind that you are grappling with these days, whether in your profession or just generally?
Within the context of persistence and consistency is how to get better. That's always the forefront of what I'm thinking about, how to get better, how to improve.
Balance and like healthy compartmentalization. I would say that like, you know, there's so much I'm trying to figure out in terms of like balancing my schedule and career with being a father and a husband and like, you know, wanting to find a way to for both of those spaces to feel supported and served and like my presence, and at the same time recognizing that both spaces will always, there's always gonna be an ebb and flow, like there's never gonna be a perfect balance of that. And healthy compartmentalization, I'd say, just because I, in that striving for balance, there's so many times where I'm working and I can't help but be like very mentally like be mentally with my wife and daughter in terms of like something that they might be going through, or vice versa, where like I'm with them and like I'm thinking a lot about what's happening work-wise and like trying to find a way to, you know, just be purely present with whatever it is that I'm doing and hope that the balance that I'm striving to strike can help me maintain that clarity and focus.
Not that either of you asked, but it does strike me that by nature of you two asking these questions and being present, you kind of already solved them. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's like you don't, the people who are not able to compartmentalize would not necessarily ask and sure. Be present. And then the people who are not improving themselves would not necessarily be focused on that. So, and be present. So I think you guys are good.
Thanks for making us feel better.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, you're all good. Last question. Just practical advice for creatives coming up.
Kind of what I touched on earlier is just being genuine and authentic to yourself, and the right opportunities will find you. And just to keep focused on what you're doing and what your sound is, and the universe will give you those opportunities when you're ready.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. And I would add, in the spirit of what we've been talking about, and I kind of always say this in terms of advice, like the life part or the mental health or the internal struggle is the hard part of this choice of being an artist. I feel like the music part is much easier than the internal dialogue that might happen when you're having a difficult time. And so finding ways to navigate that and getting to know yourself, getting to know how you talk to yourself, getting to know how to like move past any sort of like difficult negative self-talk, or if you have too much positive self-talk, being able to be a little bit more humble, or whatever it is, just like getting to know how you navigate all of the things in this career path that don't have to do with the music, that have to do with like the personal and interpersonal dynamics, is the thing that to me is like the key to like longevity in this career, even more than being a great musician.
Well, thank you both for very insightful conversation, and just this really masterpiece is the word. Like this thing is just, I'm so happy that this thing just exists, that you made this, and the music, storytelling, the entire thing is just amazing.
Oh, thanks so much.
We'll be right back.
Thank you.